Welcome to episode 3 of Words with a Wise Guy. We have survived our first two, and now we're moving on to number 3. I'm very, very excited about this episode. Kind of a local legend, I guess you could call in a lot of ways. Sitting next to me, this is Leif Yonker. Leif, thank you for joining us. We really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
We're going to get right into the movies. We got some other things we're going to talk about. Kurt is over here helping out with the show, and he's had some big events this weekend, kind of good and bad. That'll be interesting to talk about if you were listening to the last podcast. We also have Jeff and Colton, and Greg's around here somewhere, so a lot of people helping out. So thanks, everybody at WSU-TV, for helping us do this. We're really excited about continuing this. And I love movies, and I know the guy next to me. I mean, I'm an amateur compared to the love of movies that this guy has next to me. But the first thing I was going to ask is the name Leif. You know, yesterday was Leif Erikson Day. Did you know that?
I should have. I used to be in the Leif Erikson Society. I actually was named after Leif Erikson.
Well, Leif is such a great name. How come there aren't more Leifs? You don't run into too many.
Tell you the truth. Okay, for years and years and years. It wasn't until I was in my 30s I met the first other Leif ever. And it was a guy at a liquor store down south working the cash register. But lately, a lot more. I've been meeting a lot more Leifs, but they're kids. They're little kids. So it's caught on. Mom was a history buff, and I was going to be named Eric, after Eric the Red.
Okay.
And their friends didn't know that, who were also expecting. And 2 weeks before I was born, they named their son Eric. So Mom shifted gears and named me Leif Erikson, to the extent that, you know, Erikson, son of Eric, and my dad was Tom, so I'm Leif Thomason.
Very nice. I was in Iceland a couple years ago, and there are several Leifs in Iceland.
Well, sure, yeah. I mean, what's sad is a lot of people still assume I'm named after Leif Garrett, the pop star from the 70s. I'm like, I was born in 69. I was born before Garrett rose to power.
He may have been named after you. Okay, so you, just to give everybody a little bit of background if they don't know, locally Leif organizes the movie film festival, Horror Fest, that's shown downtown. And we're going to get into that. I know we're going to talk like a lot about that, but maybe talk a little bit about your background. How'd you get into movies in the first place?
Well, I'm interested in comic books, and I was a kid of the 70s, so Evel Knievel, you know Evel Knievel. Oh, yeah. A lot of kids don't know who Evel Knievel was.
I'm not a kid.
He was a daredevil stuntman who like jumped across the Snake River at Grand Canyon. Yep. He jumped across fountains at different casinos and usually crashed.
Yes.
But I was very interested in him. He was kind of a hero. So I was interested in stunt work, and that actually led me to the idea of being a stuntman for a while. And then Star Wars came out. And, you know, that movie is transformative for a lot of people. But for me, it was the making of Star Wars that showed on network TV. It's like an hour-long program, where they showed the models and the behind the scenes. And it just really, even though I'd already considered being a stuntman as a kid, it really drove home that movies, people made movies, they didn't just exist. And that, what was involved in the craft. So I actually, as a kid, I wrote my own Star Wars ripoff called Fire Fury. And
how old were you when you read that?
I was seven, or I was about eight. I think I was eight. And I started building little sets in my basement. And little, I actually tried to hang a spaceship in front of the opening credits of Doctor Who, you know, with the bug, so I could, and try to film it for a second to see if I could get like a light speed hyperspace there. But then a couple years later, I never got to make Fire Fury. I actually built some stuff for it, but I had a little film camera and I did some tests, and it was an old regular 8 movie camera where you actually put 16mm film in it. Filmed down one side of the roll, and then you flipped it over and filmed down the other side and sent to the lab. Wow. And they process it and then cut it down the middle and then tape it together. But it didn't work very well. I only got like 2 out of 100 shots, you know, that actually came out. So I gave up on doing that then. But a couple years later, Alien came out. Now, I was only 9 or 10. I turned 10 the year it was out. And that trailer just was mesmerizing. I don't know if you recall, but for a long time on the TV, they never showed any footage from the film. It was just the egg with that laser. But then the catchphrase, "In space, no one can hear you scream. Rated R." And I would I'd be upstairs like doing something, anything, and I'd hear it on the TV, and I'd go racing downstairs just to catch it. It was just, I was drawn to it, and my folks wouldn't take me. It was rated R. I was like 9 years old, and And I kept on pushing. And then my dad took my mom, and I argued, look, when we watched Omega Man on TV, she had nightmares. I didn't. Mm-hmm. And she got to go see Alien. No, it's still, it's really bloody, kid. You're not gonna. But I went to school, and this kid named Brian Ziegler was kind of holding court. All these kids were listening to him talking about something. I'm like, what's going on here? I came over and listened. And finally I said, are you talking about Alien? And he said, yeah, yeah. And I said, you saw Alien? And he was my same age, and he was in my class. So I literally went home and demanded. I threw down the gauntlet. Brian Ziegler went and saw Alien, damn it. And I'm going to go see Alien. And that night, you know, the movie, you know, there's a scene where Ash is revealed as a robot. And I literally thought my head was on fire. I mean, it was blowing me away. But the other thing that really struck me, at one point during the film, I heard whispering behind me. And I looked over my shoulder, and it was like two teenagers on a date. The girl was absolutely petrified. Like, almost, like not quite streaming tears, but tears in her eyes with her eyes big. And her boyfriend's laughing and going, it's okay, baby, it's just a movie, it's okay. And that impact, that the effect it had on the audience, of hearing grown, not just them, but other grown adults yell and scream and seeing the effect it had on the audience just blazed into my brain about then I wanted to make horror films ever since. The first thing I wrote after that was my own Alien 2, which I actually, as a 9-year-old, 10-year-old, you know, kid writing a script, I'm still telling you that the story I had was better than a lot of the sequels we got from professionals. You know, my dad had explained to me, in 2001, A Space Odyssey, why the space wheel turned, mm-hmm. you know, the centrifugal force to create, and you know, gravity, a sense of gravity. And so I just immediately took that and had in my script, I had Ripley actually gets back, but she's on a space wheel. And there are alien eggs and stuff on the space shuttle, and it breaks loose. So ultimately, I had, you know, aliens exploding when the people are fighting them, and the acid would eat through floors and suck people into space. And but the whole space wheel starts to, you know, the fall apart. So parts of it was actually multiple wheels, you know, stop rotating. So when she's trying to get from one end to the other to get to the last shuttle, you know, and before the whole thing falls into the atmosphere and burns up, some of the space wheels aren't turning anymore. So there's anti-gravity sequences where they're fighting aliens and anti-gravity. And it actually would have been pretty cool. But
so if we see that in the next Alien, yeah. Know that they were watching our show.
Well, I tell you, man, I'm seeing commercials for Aquaman, and there's a lot of stuff that's exactly like a movie I pitched in the 90s called The Blue. Even to the point where I had an infant at a big giant aquarium, and all the fish, you know, in essence, he's holding court. Like his mom is taking a Girl Scout troop there, but she had to bring the baby. And at one point, they get distracted by some kids knocking over, and she turns around and comes back to her baby, and all the fish in this giant aquarium have like huddled down around her child in a stroller, and he's pretty much just waving to them, and they're staring at her, and then they look at her and dispel. Well, now the Aquaman has a sequence very much like that. And in fact, when I pitched it to this one guy, he said, you know, this should be the new Aquaman movie. Yeah, that's what Aquaman should be.
Oh, but, that's awesome.
Yeah, so it happens. You know, and then I'm thinking maybe I actually ripped it off, but those ideas are out there, and they do pop up, you know, years later.
You were talking about the experience of seeing a movie in a theater, and something I want to talk about later is kind of, you know, is that, are we losing that, you know, with the streaming and things like that. But I remember Jaws. That was probably the first one that I saw in the theater.
Sure.
Probably a little younger. And so that was the fascinating one for me. And I wasn't allowed, like, to see a lot of those movies either. But then when I was growing up, it was when video stores started popping up.
Mm-hmm.
And so I could had a whole, you know, all these movies that were there that weren't in the theaters that I never had a chance to see. Now I could see all these movies.
Right.
And I was always drawn to the obscure horror section,
sure.
You know, that were these weird titles, or they had, you know, knockoffs of some, you know, famous movie that was maybe kind of a different kind of turn on it. And so that's how I kind of got into watching movies and then making movies with your friends and things like that. Obviously, you probably did a lot of that kind of stuff. So before we get back into more of your career, which is really fascinating, talk a little bit about the Horror Fest, because I know that's happening right now. We're like in the middle of the Horror Fest.
Sure.
And there's the flyer for it. And so maybe a little bit of the history of how long it's been going, and then what's going on here. And obviously, last night, I know there was a showing. So
yeah, well, it... okay, my wife and I moved to the East Coast a number of years ago, and I worked with a company, a production company out there for 3 years. But when you're on working TV production and film production, it's common for, you know, you'd go through bits of unemployment because the projects end. Series get canceled or the series just season is over. She was very homesick for Wichita, and I had two gigs, one working for Paramount as a freelance copywriter for their trailers, like, in a world, you know, I'd do, so I'd write commercials for movies I never even got to see. They'd just give me a synopsis, and I'd send in scripts. And then I also was working on the special effects team for a TV show called Surface, which was about aliens in the ocean. And both of those gigs ended, and that's normal, you know, not a big deal. I was, you know, having more gigs on the horizon, but she really seized on the opportunity. A friend of hers had offered her a job back in Wichita, and she's like, I have a job offer there, and you just lost two gigs. And, you know, when I, you know, so I meet a lot of filmmakers who come back from the coast, and it's the same story. My wife hated Los Angeles, and when I was a kid, I'd be like, man, I'd never come back, you know, for a woman. Whether it's like, well, you're with the wrong woman. Once you meet the right woman, when she wants to go home, lots of times you're going to end up going home. And I did. Anyway, so we've been back here for a while, and about that time, in 2007, Ridley Scott's Blade Runner was being re-released to theaters in the final cut. And unlike what Lucas did to the Star Wars films, the changes he made actually made sense. Mm-hmm. Some of it was just removing wires, you know, off of like the spinner that you can clearly see. And then that makes sense. Stuff he didn't get to do. That post-production was really rushed. And, you know, it was a problem film, the production all the way through. So there's some things he could fix, and I wanted to see it. And it was actually making money. It made a few million bucks, even though they only had 20 prints floating around. Well, I really started pushing the guys at the Warren to show it. Now, I had a little in with them, because in 2004, they had shown a movie I had made. We had remastered it for DVD, and I talked to them about having a cast and crew party there.
Is that Darkness?
Darkness, yes. Yeah. And so what was weird, what was funny and cool was that we were going to do like one show and on a Friday night for the cast and crew, just so they could finally see it. We never had a big wrap party when the movie first came out in 93. We never did. It just kind of, you know, we just kind of got it done and got it out there, hoping to move on to our next films. And, but it, you know, had gained some status over the years. So I called around and looking for prices to show the movie, and they worked out. They just said they gave it to us. They just gave us the theater. Said, I'll tell you what, you know, at that time Finding Nemo was out, and somehow they had it booked. But you know, they don't let kids in the theater after 8, mm-hmm. So like nobody was going to the late shows. They said, we'll give you the 8 o'clock, and we'll give you, you know. And so and then boom, we sold out really quick. It was mostly cast friends, and
yeah.
And they said, well, you know, might as well do the 10 o'clock too if you want. And I'm like, okay. And that turned into every they called me back the next day, and they said, you want to do it tomorrow? And we actually ended up showing it, you know, like 10 days through the Halloween weekend, all 10 o'clock shows, and they did well with it. So anyway, I had this kind of in because we'd had that previous experience. So I just started, I would send them, like, links to articles on Variety showing how Blade Runner, the final cut's doing. And this just started a process of me haranguing them. They never did show it, not until I showed it. Just over and over and over. And then that year, they did show some horror movies. And what they did was the final week of October, they showed a different movie every night. That was their thing. The Eagle, the Wichita Eagle, Rob Pakowaczyk ran an article. It wasn't until the thing was almost over. It was like Friday night after it had been running all week. And I'm like, I even asked Rod. I said, what happened? He goes, that's when they got the press. I had no idea what was going on either. They got the press. They finally called me, you know. And I said, guys, what? And I got to the theater, and they literally had a sheet this big on the door with text like this and like the lamest clip art of like a little bat and a pumpkin. Right. As the poster for the horror fest, you had to walk up to it and read it this close to know what it was. And we went and saw The Howling, a great movie, on a Friday or Saturday night, and there was like 6 people in the theater. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was on a Saturday night, and this is a great horror film. And I'm like, guys, you know, you got to promote this thing. And the reason I wanted to promote it is because I wanted it to happen. And so I really started pushing. I mean, I'd call them, and at one point, I had some friends working with a 3D conversion company, and they had versions of Plan 9 from Outer Space and Night of the Living Dead colorized, which is blasphemy, admittedly, but they had colorized 3D conversions, and I wanted to see them. I just wanted to see them, just, you know, and they were going to let me show them for free if we gave a few bucks to, like, the Kansas Food Bank or something.
Right.
And I called the Warren, and I told them all about it, and I said, I can throw in Darkness, you know, if you want another movie. And they're like, no, we have a plan, And I'm like, are you sure? Because I'm going to show these.
Six people.
Yeah. Yeah, are you positive? Because if you don't want to show them, I'm going to take them to Augusta.
Yeah.
And I did. And they said, no, we're good. We have it covered. And I'm like, all right. You know, so I drive out to Augusta. I work it out with them. I drop off the DCPs, the digital cinema prints that come on hard drives now. And we tested them. They look great. And I'm driving home between Wichita and Augusta. I'm out on 54, right halfway through. My phone rings. And it's the Warren. And they said, hey, man, do you still have those movies? I'm like, you got to be kidding me. I literally just left the theater. And they're like, oh, okay, well, sorry, dude, that's okay, we'll catch you. I'm like, whoa, what's going on? Well, apparently some of the managers, I don't know if they quit or they moved to a different theater, but the managers were gone who were normally in charge of the Old Town and the new replacements, and nobody knew what the plan was. And they couldn't find a plan. And I'm like, so you don't have a program for October. This is the first week of October already. Mm-hmm. We're actually into October. And they said, no, man. I said, I'll tell you what, let's do this. You know, I said, tonight or tomorrow, have your film booker call Warner Brothers. You can always get The Exorcist and The Shining. Those are easy to get, and they're perennials. You know, people will always go see those. And I'm going to call this company called Grindhouse Releasing, and we'll get Zombie and Evil Dead. And they said, okay. And like, this was like Tuesday, and by Thursday, I had posters up, and we had those movies booked, and I actually made a trailer. That's back when their Jumbotron was working outside. So I made a little low-resolution trailer for them to show. And they took this. I even made it lower resolution than standard def. And they put that on the giant screens in the theater. And I didn't know they could do that. I didn't know they were making DCPs. And so, like, that night when I found, and they looked, you know, the letters for the titles looked like Atari graphics,
right,
from the 8-bit or whatever. Yeah. I mean, they're all chunky. And I'm like, guys, you know, I can make an HD version of this. So I literally went to my little office and overnight recreated the commercial I made in HD, got them done. So by Friday, we had trailers running on all the screens. And that was like, you know, it was the quickest horror festival ever put together. But that's how it started. And
that, what year was that?
That was 2000. And that was 8 years ago, so 2011.
Okay, and fast forward, I know that I've been to several of them. I saw The Exorcist. That was one of the best experiences I've had, I remember, in the theater.
Yeah.
And to now that it's, I think people are most expecting it, would you say, that every year they're kind of like, hey, and then I know it's a tough thing to pull off every year.
Every year there's a new.
And what about, I know this year was particularly difficult because The Warren has been bought.
The Warren got bought by Regal Cinemas last year, and we had to largely start over. I actually, you know, in that point, a lot of the Warren cats, you know, that I'm friends with, you know, there was a lot of change up. Hey, that's the original trailer. that's that first trailer I made. I whipped that thing together in like one night.
Maybe let that play while we're chatting about it. That'll be good for people to see.
And that's how, you know, you look at it, that's a hell of a lineup. Evil Dead, Exorcist, The Zombie, and Shining. You know, for a last minute slap together, that was phenomenal. But you know, it. So what we're talking about?
So this year, how the changes of the
Regal bought the Warren, and actually the Warren, there's a lot of new policies, and for a lot of the managers, it was a pick your battle situation. So I actually went ahead and wrote Regal directly and pled my case to keep the festival going, and I sent a list of all the movies we showed. And aside from the Horror Fest, we also were doing screenings, special shows at the Palace, and then at that point we'd actually done some special shows in the middle of the summer. And so I had like 90 movies, a list of 90 movies that I'd helped coordinate to show. And so they bit, and we started talking, and we managed to, it had to kind of start over and repitch the whole thing, but we got it going for last year. Then a lot of people don't know that Cineworld is a giant company in the UK, I think the biggest theater chain in the UK and in Europe. They bought Regal as a foothold in America, and that's actually changed, that's been even more problematic, or you know, had a lot more impact than when Regal bought Warren. In fact, we're fighting out more and more. It's still happening. Like, we're losing people at Regal who are on our side, but we had to repitch, and they changed everything. They came back to us, and pretty much instead of me just curating the festival. And, you know, I'd do sponsors. I'd find sponsors. But, like, okay, when we first showed Dawn of the Dead in 2D, it was $500. And that's more than what they normally pay for a film. And there's other things I wanted to do. So I found our first sponsor ever just to pay for Dawn of the Dead and some extra advertising. And that became the trend. I would help cover riskier films, like, you know, when we showed The Gates of Hell and Demons. You know, they weren't sure about doing that. And I actually had to book Demons myself because they couldn't find it. I had to go through a distributor to find it. So I'd raise $1,000 or $2,000 just to do these more elaborate, you know, programming that that the Warren was uncomfortable with. And in essence, to guarantee that we were doing okay. And this year, though, they pretty much wanted me to just rent the theaters from them, pay for all the movies, pay for all the advertising, even handle ticketing. And but they did, and I'm like, why didn't you tell me this in January? Because now it's August, and we're supposed to start advertising September 1st. Right. And so I managed to convince them to compromise, but we still had to find a sponsor. Pretty much we had to pay for half the festival, which we'd never done before. But we did, and we got an amazing program. You know, it's...
Yeah, what are some of the movies that are coming up that you're excited about?
Well, we've shown Evil Dead 2 and the Hellraiser films, and those are big, but we have... We showed Reanimator, Stuart Gordon's Reanimator. It's based on H.P. Lovecraft's Reanimator, the second year of the festival. And it actually was a very dark print. I was not happy with it, but I didn't complain because people were still enjoying it. Mm-hmm. But we have a brand new 4K restoration off the film negative of Reanimator, and I hear it's gorgeous, bright, sharp, beautiful. That's the thing that's amazing this year. Normally, after the last few years, we've always had one movie that's like, we have a big remastered film.
Right. Phantasm was one.
Phantasm was a 4K restoration that J.J. Abrams was a fan of that movie. A lot of people don't know J.J. started. He actually worked on a movie that's like Star Beast or something this guy Don Doler did. And that's like truly backyard filmmaking, like no budget. And, you know, he helped on that as a kid. And he has a real affinity for this stuff. He actually... A lot of people don't know that J.J., after his TV stuff, his early stuff, like Alias before Lost, was in the running to do a big budget, to direct the big budget remake of Phantasm that was supposed to happen at New Line.
That would have been awesome.
And it got nixed. It didn't happen. New Line even announced it, that we're doing it, but apparently they didn't have the final contract with Coscarelli. But yeah, 4K Phantasm, you know, so when we'd announced that, we have, this year, every single title we're showing has been remastered.
You said the 4K restoration of
Reanimator. The Hills Have Eyes, the original 1977 Wes Craven movie, which is, you know, in my opinion, vastly superior to the remake. A lot of kids like the remake. To me, they look like the mutants look like Muppets, you know, to me. But I always said that the family in the original Hills Have Eyes would savage the family. Let's just put in the PG terms, they would savage the family of the remake and eat them.
That guy they got, you know, the bald guy. I mean, that's
Michael Berryman.
Yeah.
Yeah. He. You know, it's
what an iconic guy for the movie.
Oh yeah, and it's an amazing movie. And it really is a good movie and hardcore. It's the rougher. You know, some of the law movies we show are just fun.
Yeah.
You know, there's not a whole lot of humor in The Hills Have Eyes, but it's a great movie. I mean, it's really well made. But they found the actual 16mm negative, and because it was shot on 16, law movies in the 70s, like, you know, Evil Dead was shot on 16mm. A lot of people don't know how many features are actually shot on 16, but a lot of horror films are particularly. But Evil Dead and Hills Have Eyes, they found the original negative for Hills Have Eyes, and I actually, you know, I wanted to show for years this ghost story called The Changeling. And I'm finding out more and more people have never heard of it. So I'm glad we put it on a double feature to kind of make it more appealing. We wanted to show Chud. Now, I had wanted to show Chud on a double feature with Humanoids from the Deep, but Roger Corman doesn't actually let his movies get licensed out very easily. That's kind of difficult to get them. And so we just found, you know, after a few years of looking, Changeling and Chud, but Chud, this is a cheesy 80s monster movie, has this gorgeous 4K restoration. And then Changeling just came out in a 4K restoration. Changeling is actually, I found an article of a list of movies that have zero gore, but are absolutely terrifying, and Changeling's on it. So I'm going to be posting that on our Facebook page. You know, we have a group online called Wichita Big Screen.
Exactly. Yeah, I'm a member. That's where I find out most of that information.
Yeah, and it's on Facebook primarily. I have a website, wichitabigscreen.com. it just repeats the information. But if you want to be part of the conversation, because sometimes we'll take polls, like, what do you want to see? You know, it's Wichita Big Screen. It's a group on Facebook. I actually had talked about Changeling a few times now, but we couldn't find it. And, you know, just nobody had it. And this restoration just happened this year. But I was going to post this article about and I will soon, about all these movies that have no gore, but it's terrifying. Martin Scorsese said he thinks The Changeling is one of the most terrifying movies ever made, period. And it is spooky. If you surrender to the concept, it is a creepy movie.
Well, and another reason to see it in the theater.
Oh, absolutely. Particularly, yeah. See, that's one, you know, it's not, you know, every time, I mean, I'm a big horror fan, obviously. I'm a big movie fan. And I've watched movies dozens of times, if not over 100 times. And it doesn't matter what the film is, how many times I've seen it on video. It doesn't matter how big this screen TV is, 55, 60 inch, whatever. When you see it in a theater, you always see something new. There's always a detail. There's always, I mean, even seeing Rocky, the original Rocky in the theater, Talia Shire's performance, there's a scene where she gives him his dog that he likes from her store. Seen on the big screen, you could see a joy in her face and eyes that the character had evolved. The first real time you really see joy in her face, you can't really register it though in the on TV the way you do in the theater.
Or especially your phone that's like this.
Oh, God, you know, I think David Lynch had the PSA that said, if you've watched a movie on your phone, you have not watched the movie.
Right.
You know, that watching movies on your phone is BS. And, you know, it's an amazing technology. And, of course, I watch stuff on my phone, too. But people,
like,
you know.
Podcasts. Podcasts are great to watch.
They're awesome. I mean, it truly is. But there is something not only about seeing the theater. Now, the thing is, most movies.
We look a lot smaller on phone on a podcast than we would on a big screen. So this podcast is perfect for
Perfect for us. Yeah, exactly. Nobody, I've been told many times I do have a face for radio, or at least I've thought it. But it truly is a lot. I mean, a lot of people that have come, a lot of these, what I've been shocked about these movies we're showing, for me, I've always felt like the majority of them are films that people have seen. They just never had a chance to see them on the big screen.
Right.
Actually, for a lot of people, it's the first time they've ever seen them.
And that was how I felt about The Exorcist. When I saw The Exorcist, I am a little too young to have seen it in a theater.
Well, sure.
And then when I saw it a couple years ago, I was like, this is probably the scariest movie I've ever seen on a big screen. Now, I haven't seen all of them like you have, but that the music and just the tension and, you know, there's not a lot of gore in that movie.
No.
There's some, obviously, the
visceral
vomiting
effect.
Yeah. But that I walked away from that going, man, that's why they make movies and put them in a movie theater.
The experience is so completely different. I mean, it's obviously, it's immersive. Yeah. And it's not just the giant picture. It's the sound design surrounding you, being in it, hearing, particularly if it's stereo mix where you have voices behind you and sounds. I mean, that's funny about The Exorcist, you know. I mean, I fell asleep once watching The Exorcist in my house, and I woke up during one of the more hairy scenes, and it's just like, it's a hell of a thing to wake up to with her screaming, you know, with the crucifix and everybody being beaten up, you know, by the demon. It is like, wow, this movie's still powerful, and you really Absolutely. Get the sense of it. But for a while, this before Regal took over, we would preview the entire print of the movies just to make sure everything was good to go. And I ended up watching The Exorcist by myself at 2 in the morning in a theater, and I literally got like the creepy neck hairs on your neck, kind of looking around the theater like, holy shit, you know, can we cuss on this show? I don't know. It's on the internet line. But you know, I was raised in Jersey, so we use profanity as as adjectives. But it was terrifying. And the movie has an incredible power. It always has, always will. It seems like it'll dim over time, but every time you revisit, Amazing. It's like, damn, this is a tough movie.
So make sure Wichita Big Screen. So go to Facebook especially if you're from Wichita. It's a lot of not only just about the horror fest, but there's all kinds of conversations about movies, and there is always tips about movie festivals and different showings all across, you know, the area. So if you like movies, I think that's just go ahead and get on Wichita Big Screen. And
well, yeah, I try to tell people it's really just a hub for all movie news, not just horror, not just festivals.
Yeah.
Anything that's a unique screening, a documentary, a political film,
Anything kind of out of the mainstream.
Anything out of the mainstream, we try. And I tell people, theaters, I mean, the Augusta, we're helping them show Young Frankenstein the final weekend of October. But anything, for the longest time we had the Palace, and that's unfortunately that's gone, but we did, anything that was unique there too. But the Orpheum Theater will promote their shows, up in Hutchinson, the drive-in, or just sometimes people, like a little political party will show some, movie about pollution or whatever, mm-hmm. At a coffee shop. If they let us know about it, we'll promote it. It's just supposed to be a news hub for any and all unique film.
So Monday and Tuesdays, there's a couple more weeks left.
Yeah, we actually, we have four major programs still left.
And what's the one you're most excited about that's remaining? If people could go see one of them, if they're watching this and I only got time to see one, what would be the one you'd want them to go see?
I don't like doing this because it seems like it diminishes the other films. I mean, Reanimator, Hills of Eyes, we've been calling Changeling and Chud the ultimate trouble feature, and we recommend 100% to go see those films. But for 6 years, 10 years ago, the producer, George Ray Romero's original producing partner who did Martin and Dawn of the Dead and Knight Riders and Creepshow and Day of the Dead, his name's Richard Rubenstein. He ended up with the rights to Dawn of the Dead. George moved on to try to become more of a mainstream director, and he left Laurel Film. And he announced 10 years ago that he was going to do a state-of-the-art 3D conversion of the original 1978 Dawn of the Dead. And not the remake. This is the original. And back then, when he first announced it, 3D was really hot. And mm-hmm. he was going to do the full-blown conversion. Now, a lot of movies like Wrath of the Titans or Clash of the Titans that came out, the remake, got a lot of heat for how bad its 3D was. And it's because that was a rush job. At the last minute, a conversion where they would just isolate images in the frame and just make them different depths. So you actually had, flat pictures just at different depths. Well, the more elaborate 3D conversions would actually create, through CGI, the alternate angle. CG gives you, or for a 3D image, you need your left eye point of view and your right eye point of view. And those point of views are always different. So if you're looking at a hand, if you just look at whether you're left and right, you can see the background changes, your angle on the hand changes. Movies like the 3D conversion of Titanic that came out, and unfortunately we didn't get it. They did a 3D conversion of Terminator 2. They're really meticulous conversions. Well, Dawn of the Dead is supposed to be like that. In fact, I've seen a few minutes of it now, and it literally raised the hairs on my arms and neck. And there's cool shots where the zombies come at you,
right,
where somebody whips a gun into your face. All the 3D kind of mm-hmm. conceits that you expect. But what really blew me away was the epic kind of wide shot of the mall from the helicopter, because it felt like we were there. I mean, you had the real depth going 100 yards to the building and another mile beyond, and then the high shot inside the mall. It was a high shot looking down the second floor and the bottom ground floor, and you had totally that sense of depth of zombies in the foreground, zombies way down here. It felt like you could fall into it. And I was like, whoa. I mean, it really, on a little computer screen, it blew me away. So I cannot imagine what it's going to look like on a big screen. But for 6 years, I've solicited this guy. How I did to the Warren,
yes,
wore them down. It's this guy, Richard Rubenstein. And he's gotten mad at me a couple times. He's kind of cussed me out a few times for overstepping my bounds. And I just let things cool down, and then a few months later, I'd send him another article about some old interview he and George did or something, and then we just kind of go back to nothing happened. Well, finally, it's the 40th anniversary. Dawn of the Dead was finished in 78 and released around the world in 1978. Because they wanted to go unrated, they fought and looked for distributors for a long time. So in the United States, we didn't actually get it until 1979. So we have two 40th anniversaries, one of the actual completion of the film, and next year's another. I think the idea, and this isn't really official, I think he's allowing a couple theaters, ours was the first, this year to show it. Now, it's shown one other time at Beyond Fest. That was two Octobers ago in L.A., and we are the second theater to actually book it in the entire United States, the That's Warren cool. Old Town, here in Wichita, yeah, Kansas. I mean, this is a movie that fans will travel from states away to see. Now, we've announced, two other theaters have announced, one in Cleveland and one in Pittsburgh. I think he's doing it as a little bit of a test run, hoping to roll it out wider next year. But so a lot depends on our screening. But it It's we have four shows, 2 days, Monday, Tuesday. It's the last. It's the 29th and 30th. If you're going to see one movie, George A. Romero's original Dawn of the Dead in 3D. It took 6 years to get it. We got it, you know, and every year we think this might be our last year. If we end with Dawn of the Dead, I'll be a happy
man. Good way to go.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, for movie fans in Wichita, you know, thank you for being a pain in the butt to all those guys.
I have no choice. I need these movies to show here.
So I can't implore everyone enough. Seeing these movies on the big screen in downtown Wichita is one of the coolest experiences. So if you have a chance, Monday, Tuesday, the next few weeks, check it out. So I've got like 1,000 questions. I know we can't get to all of them. I know Kurt, he was interested in the relation with Wichita State a little bit, right, Kurt? You had some thought. I know we were talking about that earlier before Leaf got here.
Yeah. I went to Wichita State, and it was a group of guys, Navarro Parker.
Sure.
One of them, Lonnie Quattlebaum.
Both great guys.
Yeah, yeah. And you made a movie called, or helped produce a movie called My Day in the Barrel.
Right.
Yeah, and it was kind of a departure from you know the slasher movie. It was more of a human interest feature comedy. And just how did you get involved with some of the local filmmakers back then? Because, you know, it was kind of that pivotal moment when DV came out, and so
sure.
Filmmaking was a little bit easier and a little bit more accessible. Maybe just kind of talk about the advent of some of that, you know, desktop filmmaking and how it made impact on, you know, some kids from Wichita State and their desire to make a movie.
Well, one thing about saying that the film was different from what I normally would pursue, I love all types of movies. Going in Style with George Burns is one of my absolute all-time favorites. Amadeus, you know, I mean, if I give you my top 10 list, it's only a couple horror films. Mm-hmm. I love all types. Now, as far as me getting involved with My Day in the Barrel, you know, back then, okay, when I first started trying to make Darkness, I was only 17 years old. I was 17, I wrote the script, and I was 18 when I was really pitching it hard. And I did talk. I actually spoke to Navarro Parker's dad, Randy Parker, and other people who were involved in the making of King Kung Fu, the producer of a slasher movie that was made here in the 80s called Night Screams. His name is Dillis Hart. I talked to him. I tried to talk to anybody and everybody to try to get, well, for one, some investors and some support. How do we, you know, pulling gear together to make Darkness? And one thing is a lot of cats, I'm not going to name names, but there's a lot of people who are actually really burned out, who had felt kind of cheated, who felt angry about where their careers had gone. And they're very discouraging. I mean, they actually were just telling me, you can't make a horror film. You can't make a movie in Wichita. King Kung Fu, you know, the producer, Bob Walterscheid, I met with him, and he was encouraging. You know, he's kind of a big kid. Even now as a 70-something or 80-something-year-old, he's still like a big kid. You talk to him. And he, you know, he didn't invest in Darkness was not his cup of tea. But he actually gave me all the paperwork, like the photo releases and the actor's releases, location releases, that he had paid an attorney to drop for him. He gave me, back then, there was no internet. You couldn't just go, or you couldn't buy Mark Litwack's book of legal forms and stuff. It was actually hard to find those things. And he gave those to me so I could, you know, white out stuff and change names and use them for my film. And I did. So he was actually quite encouraging. And, but, you know, other people worked on King Kung Fu who did help me. Tim McGill actually stars in the film and helped did special effects on King Kung Fu. He gave us guns and stuff, you know, and blanks for the movie. But actually, a lot of people straight up were discouraging. And I understand now that I'm older, I understand why they're kind of bitter. Lots of times when you're in filmmaking, you do favors for people, and those people never return the favor. After I got Darkness done and we got released, I just made myself a pledge that I would help everybody at least once. If any young director or filmmaker came to me looking for help, I would help them at least just once, you know, once, just because I love making films, mm-hmm. and I love movies, and I did not want to be like those cats who just tried to discourage me. I mean, it was really tough. You got to remember, Darkness was made before Clerks or before El Mariachi came out and gave these examples of how to make movies cheaply. So I'm going around saying, we have no real budget, but you know, we're going to make a movie, like, really, you're going to make a movie in Wichita with no money. I'm like, yeah, and we did. I mean, actually, Darkness, what it is with Darkness, I tried to raise about $150,000 to shoot it on 16 millimeter. And I actually, like Evil Dead,
right.
like Texas Chainsaw. and like Hills and Eyes. And I found a guy in Clearwater, Kansas, who actually had a full package of 16 millimeter gear that he had paid thousands of dollars to have refurbished and cleaned, and it was just sitting out there. And he made me a great offer, but I had no money. You know, he's going to rent it to me. And the reason he wouldn't give it to me, he told me, because normally I just give it to you to make your film, but I've loaned it to people who mistreated it. Mm. And at one point, he had it brought back from a shoot where the guy let it be downstream, smoke from a big bonfire. And he said the thing literally had, like, a soot on it and stink of, like, wood and smoke. And so he said, after that, I just, it's a precedent. I mean, a rule now. I charge a little bit, you know, so people take it seriously and understand that, you know, what they're getting. So I still had to raise some money, and I couldn't. I can just, nobody ever, to be honest, I mean, as much as I have an adoration for Kung Fu and respect for Night Screams, neither of them were prime examples of making a lot of money off a movie. They didn't have very successful releases. And in fact, there was some controversies around Night Screams and its financing that actually in the courts and paper and stuff. So it was hard to point to anything saying we can do this. So ultimately, I took the lesson from Sam Raimi and company. When they made Evil Dead, they had primarily, as students, only done comedies. They made the decision to make a horror film as a commercial venture to get their career going. To prove they could make a good horror film, they made a short film version on Super 8 film of Evil Dead called Within the Woods. I think they spent a couple $1,000. It's like 20 minutes long. And they would show that short film version to investors, dentists. At one point, they said that these guys own a grocery store that would close at 11 o'clock at night. So they set up their projection like right in the aisle.
So you were trying to make that movie to raise some money to make it real legitimate.
I made Darkness. I decided to go ahead and make the full feature-length version, but I actually shot it on Super 8 film. Mm-hmm. And people think this is revisionist history, that I'm saying, like, I shot it on Super 8 with no intention of ever releasing it. I even shot it at 18 frames a second, a normal movie shot at 24, because I figured that I am on such a tight budget. If I shoot at 18 frames, it actually just gives me a little more shooting time. Mm-hmm. And I figured nobody's ever going to see this thing except a handful of investors. And if the movie falls down here and there, I can explain to them. Imagine this happens in this scene instead of this. Imagine this happens, you know. But it took us almost a year to get in the can. Because
this is the trailer, by the way, for those of you watching on YouTube. This is the trailer for
Yeah, that's the old trailer for the DVD release from 2006.
Yeah, which, you know, I've heard people talk about this movie, and you were talking about El Mariachi, and I think a lot of people compared those two movies, because I think El Mariachi was like 7,000 is the number that they, you know, comes out.
Yeah, 7,500. Yeah. I mean, now the version you see in the theater, they spent over 300,000.
Yeah.
In polishing it. But Mariachi, that's one thing people think, like, well, so Darkness is your Evil Dead. No, Darkness is my Within the Woods. Darkness is your Mariachi. No, actually, Robert Rodriguez spent a lot more money on his short films than he did on Mariachi. I think he spent $14,000 on one short film.
Well, we got to get Darkness back into the Horror Fest. I think that would be something that would be really cool for a lot of Wichitans to.
Has not been announced yet.
Oh, so we have some breaking news, maybe.
I'm not really supposed to say this, but I have turned down Blu-ray deals for the last 5-6 years. We've been offered, a lot of people want to do a Blu-ray, and I said, you know, this. I actually was offered a DVD release years and years before we ever took one, because I told them, I said, you know, Darkness, again, was so low budget. When we looked around how to transfer our film, I didn't want to cut the film. You cut Super 8, you get down to Super 8, you know, your thumb is bigger than the frame. It's real easy to damage, and so I wanted to transfer the raw footage to video and cut it. We looked around. Isn't it cost us around $5,000 back then to do it? Back, you know, to get a telescene, a professional film telescene, at least $5,000. And I couldn't afford it. We just had no money. I was working part-time jobs, man. I was working, like, driving a forklift. We are famously now, I mean, years later, we told the story that we were selling Plasma Alliance on Central daily, or not daily, but every week or whatever you can do it. And we would take the checks and go buy film for Moeller's camera. And we first would go eat because you're always dizzy after you get your plasma. And then we'd go buy a couple rolls of film to shoot more special effects of when we were blowing up the monsters and all at the end. So then it was just pathetic. It really was. I mean, it was sad, but that's how poor we were. I was still working driving forklift at McCormick Armstrong.
I understand some of those early career moves that you do it for the love of.
But then you turn it around years later and say, we sold our blood to make a vampire movie.
Exactly. Yeah.
And the fact is, it was sad at the time, but then later it's a great story.
What's the big announcement?
We finally signed a Blu-ray deal, and we waited for the right company, and it's a big company, and they have done a 2.5K scan of the original camera element, and I'm in the process of reassembling Darkness.
That's so exciting.
We will have a Blu-ray release next year, and if the festival happens again, we'll probably show it in the festival.
I think if you announce that you're going to get just a ton of people interested in watching that.
Well, the first transfer ever released, if you watched it on VHS, we actually did that in my friend's kitchen with a piece of paper we bought at Walmart and spray painted flat white. We set up this camera. It's like we had a friend, not this camera, but we had a friend who worked at a production place. He gave us a decent camera. We put on a tripod. We literally had it just above the Super 8 projector, and we videotaped it off the wall just as a work print. Thinking, okay, this will show the potential. Because right. At that point, we realized there was enough stuff being dumped to video around the country, national releases, that was worse than what we had shot. We're like, well, instead of showing it to investors, we don't really want to remake Darkness again. It took so long to film it. We'll get it released on video, and then we'll make a new movie. Use that as the demo to raise financing for a new film, which was the plan. But so we figured, again, this is just a work print. We'll show this to distributors, and somebody will put up the money to do it properly. And long story short, that little version originally was released all over the world. The version we did in the guy's kitchen. It was released on VHS a few times in the States. It was released on DVD in Europe and Germany and Japan. And it wasn't until 2002 that we did an actual decent transfer. And that version didn't get released due to a number of reasons until 2006. But that transfer was a professional transfer, but truthfully, it wasn't that much more advanced than what we should have been able to do in 93.
Right.
It looked good, and it was definitely a vast improvement, the trailer you just watched. But even the trailer you just watched is not true 16:9. I decided I liked the way it looked cropped to more of a widescreen version. The distributor insisted on stretching the video. It was a standard definition transfer. It wasn't a 16:9 anamorphic. They actually stretched it. So even though the DVD looks vastly superior to the original VHS, it actually was hamstrung and softened for its release by the video being distorted. So this new version we're doing, hands down, will blow away visually any version previously. And a lot of people won't believe it's Super 8. I had people of that DVD version assumed it was 16mm at the very worst. Some people thought it was 35 at moments. No, not throughout. There's times where it falls down badly. But when it looks good, it looks really good. This new version should be amazing. We'll actually have a real 2K DCP of the movie when we're done that can play theaters.
That's so exciting.
So yeah.
Well, we could sit here and talk for
hours
and hours. We might have to have you back again.
I go off on tangents pretty easily.
Well,
I can talk
this
about
is some awesome stuff, and I definitely thank you for coming. We're going to hit on a few other things here. I definitely want to talk to Kurt about his marathon. If you were listening to the last podcast, we were going to we wished him well, but we're going to come back to some movie things right at the end in our final five movies that we've been doing. So Kurt, one of our producers here, so there's a picture of Kurt if you're wondering what he looks like. I know that a lot of people see him running around. He ran Chicago Marathon. Kurt, how'd you do?
I finished. wasn't the A plan, but got through. I got my Boston qualifier, literally hit a pothole at mile 21. So
you stepped in a pothole.
I stepped in a pothole. It was slick out, and it was just
With basically a 10K to go, you stepped in a pothole.
It was God's plan. It had been. But the good thing is the guy I ran with, Bob Hornung, a teammate of mine from the Shocker Track Club road racing team. He got a PR. He's 48 years old and ran a 2:56, which is amazing. And we just had a blast. My wife ran, and she did the Galloway method, which is like a run walk at a certain interval progression. And during her walks, she would just take Instagram photos and just basically caught the entire experience, and so she had a great time. But yeah, it's just we've never seen Chicago that way, and we probably never ever will. And I think that was kind of the coolest thing, is just being able to run in the streets and have all these buildings around you, and literally, you know, hundreds of thousands of people just. It's just a scream tunnel.
And you beat an Olympic gold medalist in the race.
We were chasing.
She was like 114 years old, but
yeah.
Joan Benoit finished behind
her. Yeah, she was going for a world record on her. I think it's a master's record, like 301 or something like that, and she missed it. But man, not for lack of trying. I mean, she's pretty darn amazing.
Yeah. And so Mo Farah won the race.
Yeah.
And do you have any pictures of Mo that
I think
you
I might
could
have
share?
One. Yeah, there's Mo. Yep, there's Mo. See, I was there was a hospitality tent, and there was rumors that he was going to come around. So we were kind of waiting around, and sure enough, as soon as he hit, you know, people that knew who he was just mobbed him.
Right.
And keep in mind, this is like the Michael Jordan of running.
You know,
this guy is famous.
Gold medalist.
Medalist, no big deal. Yeah, he's smiling, you know, giving his post-win looks there.
And then look who's in the middle, right behind me.
Right there in the middle.
With his Wichita State track and field hat on.
Yep, yeah, former decathlete Seth Buck was had his camera ready, and he said, get in there. So I hobbled my way over there and just mobbed Mo and the winner of the female, the women's race, too. So, yeah, that's all awesome. In all, it was an awesome day. Yeah, had a good time.
Well, and, you know, congratulations. I've watched some marathons. I would never attempt to actually complete a marathon. So you definitely have got me. Leaf, have you ever thought about doing a marathon?
Oh, I just finished one up myself.
Did you? Okay.
No, I'm not a runner.
Yeah. A funny side note and perhaps a dovetail of the whole thing is like Seth Buck, who was with us and basically, you know, following us around with the camera and giving us support along with Bob's family. He just kind of worked his way into the mix. I mean, he was not supposed to be at the finish line.
That sounds like something Seth would do.
Yeah, and so he grabbed, and if you see he has like a blue Zurich, you know, thing, he just grabbed that. People are ditching clothes at the start, so he just, you know, geared up with whatever he can find to make himself look like a photographer and had his camera and just looked the part. So
former Shocker decathlete, by the way, Seth Buck.
So, he was rocking it.
Well, here around Wichita State, there's quite a bit going on. Our cross-country team is heading to Wisconsin for the pre-nationals. That's a big race this weekend. So if you're a fan of Shocker track and field, if that's one of the reasons why you're listening, they've got a big race. They're in with a bunch of national-level cross-country teams. And so they're excited for that. We have some of our athletes are getting ready to do some testing. So a lot of interesting stuff going on around Shocker track and field. One thing that happened this week, we do a fundraiser every year, and one of the things we do is Coach Rainbolt every year. So Coach Rainbolt, our head track and field coach, is an avid golfer. And so he's turned 61 years old. And since he was 57, I believe, he walks the number of holes that he is years old. So he's 61, so he walked 61 holes of golf. 43,000 steps, took 11 hours. I think it was about 25 miles. So he almost did a marathon when we're talking about marathons. And started at, there's a picture of him. I think that's the first shot in the morning as the sun was rising and went literally until the sun was setting. And so there's a cool video on Shocker Track Backers is a website that one of our alumni put together of Coach the highlights of Coach Rainbolt. And a lot of stuff on social media. So if you get a chance, check that out. Congratulations to Coach Rainbolt and his accomplishments. And the goal is how long can he go achieving this goal? You know, he's 61, and he's committed to continuing to do it every year. And so he's we'll wait and see how next year goes at 62. So it was hot and windy. It was a rough day. He about died there at the end.
That's awesome.
He was laying down on the ground waiting for the final hole. So a couple other things before we finish up. So I had a chance to go see Henry Rollins at the Orpheum. And Henry Rollins is a super interesting guy. He's a world traveler. Last person we had on our podcast was a world traveler, and we talked. And that's my Instagram of who I want to be someday, and want to be fit like him and travel around the world and do all kind of stuff. So he basically gives a kind of stand-up comedy, but more of a storytelling deal at the Orpheum. He does it every couple of years. and he's a great photographer, and I had a chance to see him. So if you ever get a chance to see Henry Rollins, pretty interesting guy to see and to follow. And then the last thing I saw, are you a UFC fan? You ever watch the UFC?
A little bit.
I'm not a huge fan. I'm track and field and some more traditional sports. But did you see what happened after the UFC fight?
Yeah, it seems like when I see more of the controversies.
Yes.
Because they're all over my news feed.
So
where the one cat jumped out of the ring and attacked the trainer.
Yeah, so the what was his name? Khabib fought McGregor.
Right.
And he won. He beat McGregor. And then I guess there was trash talking going on.
Yeah.
He climbs the fence and jumps into the crowd to beat up, like, the Irish guys that are in the crowd. I've never seen, you know.
Well, he fought the, apparently, the trainer. McGregor's, the guy who teaches him martial arts.
Yeah.
It was actually his trainer that he was going.
And then the guy jumped in and hit McGregor, kind of
they
sucker punch.
They jumped McGregor. I mean,
I was thinking about this, Kurt. That would be like Mo Farah climbing the fence at the Chicago Marathon and into a bunch of Ethiopians. Like, just like, you know, raining havoc after a marathon.
I think after a marathon, there is no climbing. That's just my unprofessional addition there.
So, and crazy stuff. I didn't see the fight, but I heard about that. I don't know if that's good or bad for UFC. It's probably good. I don't know. It's probably going to help them a lot. But
They'll say it's terrible for the sport. I think they actually banned, like, gave lifetime bans to the guys who jumped McGregor. But the fact is, I mean, I didn't know anything about the fight until all this, controversy hit. So obviously it helps them. You know.
So we finish up every show with the final five movies I've been watching. And it's so interesting because you're here. So we're going to hear what you think of some of the movies I've been watching. But Kurt, have you seen, you've been running. You probably haven't seen a movie lately.
No, I've been watching the history of the marathon, the spirit of the marathon documentary.
Fitting.
On a loop.
Now, right. Jeff's back there. Jeff, have you seen any movies or want to see any movies coming up since it's kind of the, you know, holiday season for horror movies?
Well, I definitely want to go see Halloween. It's coming out soon, but now I really want to go see Dawn of the Dead.
You're definitely going to, let's go together. We're going to go see Dawn of the Dead. And then leave, what about the new Halloween? Is that something that are you interested in?
You know, this is the thing. I am an optimist, but I don't really get my hopes up for movies anymore. And to tell you the truth, though, there's enough going on with this new Halloween film. The return of John Carpenter doing the score, Jamie Lee approaching it differently than she did with H20. She actually really recognized that the character she played in 78 was a real character and that she'd actually have to play her differently. She's not just Jamie Lee. You know, she actually is, you know, Laurie Strode. Mm-hmm. There's just a lot of things about it that I'm actually having my hopes up.
So you're going to see it?
Not only am I going to see it, the Warren East is showing the original Halloween tonight and tomorrow, I believe.
Oh.
And and the thing is about this new Halloween, it's actually a direct sequel to the very first movie. It's actually a brand new part two. You know, in part two, they revealed, the 1981 movie or whatever, that Laurie was his brother and all. They actually talk about that in the commercial for the new film. They say, no, that was just an urban myth, you know, that the killer was related.
Right.
And they actually discuss, like, things about, and they it actually starts the movie, the whole series over with a brand new part two. So I'm going to go see the original Halloween in the theater, so when the new film comes out, I'll have seen the original on the big screen just recently, and then go see this brand new part two.
Awesome. So that's a lot of good stuff. I love October for the kind of throwback of all the horror movies, and they come out with some new stuff. I think it's one of the best months for movies every year. So the final five movies, here's my last five. I've been going through my collection of 600 movies. Now, how many movies do you own? Do you even know?
I don't know anymore. There was a point where we knew we had about 1,000 VHS. That was back in the day. We had, my brother and I, you know, we both kind of, we got to the point where we'd stop both buying the same movie because, you know, we'd end up watching each other's prints. So that actually started increasing our numbers even more. But no, I mean, I have a bunch, you know, I have at least 600.
At least. He heard my number. He kind of chuckled at my 600.
I just said it was a good start. Now, I was being a wise guy. I'm not saying I have 10,000. I got a bunch, though.
Yeah, I'm going to have to borrow some of yours. Okay, so the last few movies I've seen, this is going alphabetically, so I just so you know, that's how this goes.
Okay.
Half-Baked with an early Dave Chappelle movie.
Dave Chappelle is always funny.
There was some early genius. You know, if you watch that, I heard that they didn't, they kind of strayed from the original
Jim Brewer
script.
What's
yeah,
that
Jim
guy's
Brewer,
name?
Yeah, from Saturday Night Live.
He's hilarious, isn't it?
But I watched a little bit of it and read about it, that they kind of strayed from the original script a little bit because they wanted to sell it a little more, so they had to kind of soften some of the marijuana references and things like that. Obviously, the whole movie's about that, but they made it a little more PG-13, I guess, is what I heard. Happy Gilmore, that's the next one alphabetically, which is some people would say when Adam Sandler was still funny. Yeah. So, some of his later movies are different, but this was early Adam Sandler when he was, I think, still on Saturday Night Live. And
you know, there's a lot of Adam Sandler stuff I like, and Happy Gilmore obviously has funny stuff.
Bob Barker and him in a fight. I mean,
there's a lot of hilarious stuff in that. But there's people who complain now about him, the movies he's making with his buddies. Like they kind of don't really, seem challenged by the movies anymore. They're almost just doing a vacation. Hey, we're going to film a movie in Hawaii.
Right.
But who of us wouldn't do that?
Absolutely.
If given the opportunity. Look, your career is kind of in this weird limbo, but you get to make a lot of money. You get to recruit all your buddies. You get to go hang out on a location and film a movie, a Western or whatever they were doing for Netflix. It's not my cup of tea, but I can't blame the cat, I'd be making if they just wanted to knock out some quickie, comedies, but everybody's making good money, I guarantee you.
And people are still going, he's got a fan base that sees those movies. So.
But he's cranking out all these movies for Netflix, but more power to him, man, it's...
The early Adam Sandler stuff, definitely. Yeah. Happy Gilmore was funny. Saw a movie maybe not a lot of people have heard of called Hard Candy. It's
Very good movie.
Real young Ellen Page. I think she was like 17, and there's only like four people in the movie. And
I think that's her debut, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think maybe in terms of a starring, she might have had like a small role in some other stuff, but kind of a crazy movie if you don't know what it's about. I don't want to spoil it.
It's a tough movie. It's pretty tough, and it's definitely worth a watch. It had a lot of buzz on it. The director of it was coming off when it showed at Sundance was so hot that he was offered 30 Days of Night, which was a big-budget vampire movie that Sam Raimi was producing. And he did make it to mixed results. But Hard Candy is definitely a very good film worth seeking out.
And then I also watched Hardcore Henry.
I haven't seen it. I've heard mixed.
I actually saw it in the theater and enjoyed it enough to get the DVD. And it's a first person. It's like the old video game Doom.
Sure.
It feels like that. Basically there's like 200 kills in it or something like that. But it was kind of unique in the fact that the entire movie you're the person. You're Henry basically, and you're
his point of view.
Yeah, and it's very violent. It's a little shaky at times, so you kind of walk out with a little bit of a headache. But very effective, and I would recommend anyone to see it. It's probably in the theater worth seeing more than like you're talking about on a TV because of the experience. I walked out of that theater, and me and a buddy had seen it. We just thought, hey, let's go see this movie. It seems kind of different. And one, we kind of both were, I think we had to take some Tylenol once we got done.
Right.
But two, we were paranoid looking around our shoulder because we had kind of been that guy for 2 hours, and then people were trying to kill him for 2 hours.
Right.
So you walk out, and your mindset is kind of like, you're looking at things from a different
interesting.
Perspective.
That's interesting.
So it was really good. And then the last one I saw in the theater, actually, I went and saw Evil Dead 2. And for those of you that haven't seen Evil Dead 2, so much fun. And it was in the theater, so if you missed it in Wichita last week, what a fun movie.
It's worth seeking out on Blu-ray. And Bruce Campbell literally transforms into a living animated like cartoon character.
Yeah, it's so amazing.
In that movie, you get to see, like I said, Sam Raimi and his buddies when they were doing their student films in college. They were doing slapstick comedies. They were doing Three Stooges films. And in Evil Dead 2, you really see them starting to show their, some of his, physical, comedy, or it's not really comedy, but some of his physical performances.
I don't know if funny is the right word, but it's
it is
entertaining.
Funny. No, it is a zany movie, man. It's wacky, man. But it stampedes. Any direction it goes in, it stampedes full tilt that direction. So I mean, it's a
great movie.
It's a weird movie in that when they made it, they were obligated to deliver it as an R-rated film. They were doing it for Dino De Laurentiis under his deal he had with Universal. So they actually thought they were doing the soft version, and it still got an X rating. So that's why, if you remember in the movie, it begins with this weird title. It says Rosebud Releasing. They actually had to create a separate label to release it. And so it still came out unrated. But that was their idea of what, you know, they were actually trying to make it funnier, a little bit lighter, and which is actually their interest. I mean, you see them go full tilt in Army of Darkness, the third movie, with skeletons literally doing the Three Stooges eye poke thing and all. I mean, I'm surprised Sam hasn't made a full tilt Three Stooges movie yet, but because that's their true love.
Awesome. Well, thank you once again for coming. Once again, Wichita
me.
Big Screen is the Facebook page. The Horror Fest down in the Warren Theaters downtown Wichita. There's a couple more weeks left. A bunch of really good movies.
We got four major programs. So we got four. You know, we got four big movies coming up, or programs coming up.
And Leaf will probably be at all four of them, so get a chance to stop by, buy a T-shirt, get some flyers, and get a poster. There's all kinds of stuff.
A lot of the swag goes to Lap Animal Shelter. We raise money every year for Lap Animal Shelter, at least $1,000, you know, but we're hoping to do more. So we got T-shirts and buttons and posters, and if you're on the fence about buying a T-shirt for $15, remember, it's going to go feed a little hungry puppy or kitten.
I know a few people out there that are now going to buy shirts just for that.
Yeah,
so. Good guy, great guy. Thank you so much for what you do for the city of Wichita and all of movie
my
lovers
pleasure.
All around. Thank you very much. That wraps episode number 3, and thanks for watching or listening, and we're going to continue to hopefully bring you some great, interesting people from the city of Wichita, just like Leaf every time. So thanks a lot, and have a great week.